My name is Tammy Shreve. I am the chair. Ms. Poe, would you please provide a roll call?
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Flowers? Dr. Bohansky?
Present.
Dr. Davy?
Present.
Mr. Dinar? Dr. Gill?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Dr. Malott? We have a quorum.
All right, thank you.
Yes, present too.
Oh, Dr. Flowers, good to see you.
Good morning.
All right, moving to item three. We do have a new board member. She couldn't make it today. We're hoping she'll be here next month, Melanie LaBoy. So she will properly introduce her at our next meeting. If anyone would like to fill out a board survey regarding this meeting, please contact the board staff and they'd be happy to provide that to you. And also, as always, a big thank you to our staff and our attorney, Ms. Galvin, for all the work and preparation they do for these meetings. They keep us literally organized and moving in the right direction. It's a lot of work gathering all this documentation and getting it to us so we can read it in a timely manner. Number four is a call to the public. Is there anyone that would like to speak for a call to the public? Hearing none, moving to item five, council update. Ms. Galvin, do you have an update for us?
I do not, nothing since last month.
All right, thank you. Item number six, if you could put your phone on mute or if you're on Zoom, your Zoom on mute, I could hear the news in the background, it sounds like. Right, thank you. Consent agenda, discussion, consideration, possible action. Are there any, is there any request to remove any items from the consent agenda? Hearing none, is there any recusals? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
I so moved, Dr. Bob.
Dr. Bob, thank you. Is there a second?
Seconded.
Thank you, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. And Dr. Malott, I see you joined us. Thank you.
Sorry.
That's okay. We're just trying to make sure we count everybody here. All right, we're going to move. We have a timed item at 9, but we're going to move to item 13, discussion, consideration, and possible action concerning formal petition for review of rule pursuant to ARS 4130-1033 or ACC 4526-207 permitted by Bradley Bavoing. Executive Director, do you have a summary?
Yes, Madam Chair. Arizona Revised Statute 41-1033 permits any person to petition a state agency to either make, amend, or repeal a rule. Dr. Boivin submitted such a petition requesting that the board review the rule R-426-207, continuing education, and specifically review subsection C that addresses how this board requires continuing education in a prorated fashion for the first licensure period. So once an individual is licensed, they are notified of their prorated CE requirements for that initial period. And in his petition, Dr. Boivin states that the rule disregards previously completed hours that have been completed for licensure in other states. The petition further states that prorating by month fails to capture many hours that would otherwise be given equal consideration at renewal, and the petition asks the board to revise the CE rules to allow applicants by universal recognition or by credential to use CEUs obtained within 2 years of their first renewal date. And in doing so, the requirements for new licensees would be more consistent and equitable with the requirements for their colleagues that are already licensed in the state. So the board's options are to either reject the petition and state why, or initiate a rule change, or make a new rule. I'm not sure that make a new rule is the appropriate solution because a rule already exists. So really, I think your options are to discuss this matter, arrive at a decision, and decide whether you're going to reject the petition or put this on the list for a possible, for a rule change.
Dr. Bob.
Ms. Shreve, I think you might be muted. You're muted.
Thank you. We mute, we unmute. Thank you. Dr. Bob, please.
Let's go ahead and put this forward as something to look at. We've had so little information on these universal applicants as to what they've accomplished or not accomplished, and I think it's time we get down to the bottom of really taking a nice hard look at what's an equitable way of appropriating continuing education requirements and really have a good, frank, open discussion about it. I appreciate the doctor's comments. I think we've gone through a period of emergency changes and this and that and the other thing, and it would be healthy for us to step back and take a look at what we're actually looking for.
All right. Any other comments?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Dr. Flowers.
Yes, I agree with Dr. Bohansky on this, but I think it also needs to be expanded to anybody who is currently licensed in another state or jurisdiction before being licensed in Arizona, and see if that's also applicable to them. I mean, because, for example, if somebody is licensed elsewhere, comes in either by credential or any other way of getting a license in Arizona, and their renewal period for the first cycle is like 3 months, I can see where it'd be annoying to have to prorate everything in the world if they're already doing CEs elsewhere. But I think it should be not just for the universal applicants, but for really anybody. But of course, that will be looked at, you know, we look at the whole issue.
Any other comments or discussion? All right, so then do we need a motion then to put it on an agenda item to look at it more in more detail? Dr. Bob or Dr. Flowers, do you want to make a motion for that?
So moved.
And a second?
A second.
All right, we have a motion and a second to go in more depth at another meeting about this issue. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. We're going to move to item number...
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
In the interim, because the rule is in the state that it is currently in, the applicant is going to have to comply with the rule.
Trying. Caitlin's almost ready.
Pardon me? I just want to make that clear that while the board has made the decision to look at the issue more in depth, this applicant is going to have to comply with the rule as it currently reads.
Thank you. We're going to move to item 14, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding Ralph Earl's audit material from 2015 and 17 regarding continuing educations. Ms. Poe, did you have an update?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. And then also a request when we're done with item 14, if we could move to agenda item 17. I do have Dr. Desolaire on the line. I believe her attorney may be joining as well. Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the board, this agenda item relates to the Continuing Education Committee's review of Dr. Earl's CE submitted for the 2015 to 2017 CE audit. At the May 8th, 2020 board meeting, the board reviewed Dr. Earl's supplemental materials and found a deficiency of 9.75 units, including 0.5 units in domestic violence, child abuse. It was the consensus of the board to table the matter and allow Dr. Earl the remaining time left of his deadline to submit or complete new continuing education to remedy the deficiency. The board office received Dr. Earl's newly completed CE courses on May 18th, 2020. Board staff is requesting direction from the board on whether or not Dr. Earl meets the continuing education requirements for this audit. All documentation has been provided for your review. school. I'm not sure Dr. Earle is on the phone or not, but that does conclude my summary of the case.
All right, thank you. Are there any comments from the board?
Yes, Ms. Shreve?
Yes, Ms. Dr. Flowers.
Yes, I was the individual who reviewed the documentation initially for Dr. Earle. And so I spent a lot of time reviewing that, but bottom line on this is he was lacking those 9 3/4 hours, but he did submit documentation to us for CEUs completed during May of 2020. He completed 11. He needed 0.5 of domestic violence. That was definitely there. And so indeed with those additional hours he completed, that satisfies the deficiency in the audited renewal cycle. And he may use the additional 1.25 hours for the current licensure renewal, but the other hours cannot be used for this new cycle as well. But otherwise, at this point, I believe, is in compliance. And I'd like to make a motion that he's now in compliance with CEs because he remedied the deficiency.
All right, thank you. Is there a second?
I second that, Dr. Bob.
Thank you, Dr. Bob. So we have a motion and a second. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. We'll move now to item 17. Ms. Poe?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the board. On May 27th, 2020, the board office received Dr. DeSolaire's 2020 psychologist application for license renewal. Board staff noted that Dr. DeSolaire answered yes to question number 15 of the application. This question relates to being sued or prosecuted relating to practice as a psychologist. Dr. DeSolaire has provided additional documentation denying all allegations regarding this matter, which has been provided for your review. Dr. DeSolaire is present on the phone. I believe her attorney may be joining as well. Not sure if they would like to make a statement or just available for board member questions, but that concludes the summary of the case.
All right. Board members, do you have any questions for the doctor? Hearing none, doctor, would you just like to make a statement, an opening statement?
Yes, thank you. For the record, I would like to state that I was appointed by the Department of Child Safety under the court's direction. This was a court-ordered case. I actually had been hired by the court to provide psychotherapy to the client. Prior to this arrangement, therapeutic visitations had been attempted by two prior therapeutic intervention specialists. And both of those professionals were also appointed by DCS through the court, and both of them deemed visits inappropriate. Mother was inappropriate with the daughter. She was responding in a way that was harmful to the little girl, and they decided to terminate the therapeutic visits between the little girl and the mother. Two professionals deemed the visits inappropriate and furthermore deemed no contact period between mother and the little girl. At that point, I was hired on through the department under the court's direction. And the allegations against me are that the family is upset that the therapeutic visits were terminated and suspended. And there's a major lawsuit. And this family is suing the entire Department of Child Safety. And they're also suing everybody that took part on the case. And so I'm one of the members or one of the people listed due to the fact that I was the therapist on board for the mother. They've attacked me with some negligent claims, and I do not believe that I act in a negligent manner on any of the claims.
All right, thank you.
I was actually the third opinion, and Yeah, I can supply further documentation, and I think that you do have that.
Yes, we have all the documentation. Thank you. Thank you for being here and for your comments. So the doctor's applying for a renewal. And so if we renew this, we could also request, is that Ms. Galvin, that the this court case is resolved, that she notify us on its outcome?
That's correct.
Okay.
Dr. Bob, I'm moving that we renew the license and request an update as available.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Yeah, a lot of seconds here. All right. We got a motion and several seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All right. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Doctor, again, thank you for joining us today. We're going to move to item number 15. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding renewal application submitted by Robin Coots. Ms. Poe?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the board. On May 6, 2020, the board office received Dr. Coots' 2020 psychologist application for license renewal, requesting voluntary inactive status. Board staff noted that Dr. Coots answered yes to questions number 9 and 11 of the application. These questions relate to investigation.
I can't. Can you hear her?
Can't hear her.
I can't hear her either.
Krishna, can you start over after receiving your application on May 6th?
Yes. Can you guys hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. On May 6th, the board office received Dr. Kurtz's psychologist application for license renewal, requesting voluntary inactive status. Board staff noted that Dr. Kurtz answered yes to questions number 9 and 11 of the application. These questions relate to investigations and disciplinary action by an agency or regulatory jurisdiction. Dr. Coots has provided additional documentation regarding the matter in which her psychologist license with the Alabama Board of Examiners in Psychology is currently on probation. Dr. Coots' renewal application requesting to transition to voluntary inactive status has not been processed. Board staff is requesting direction from the board. All documentation has been provided for your review. I did obtain documents as well that was provided as supplemental documentation to the board, confirming with the Alabama board the status of her license with that board. I do not believe Dr. Coots is on the phone today, but that concludes my summary of the case.
Thank you. So she used the wrong version, and you have all the documentation you need now, correct?
Yes, I have a signed copy of all of the orders and probation order from the Alabama board. They emailed that to me a couple days ago.
Okay. Any thoughts, comments?
This is Dr. Gill.
Yes.
Question is, my understanding is that Dr. Coots is on probation at this time. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And when does her probation end?
The Alabama board did not specify a time frame. Rather, the probation is in effect until she completes the required CE and pays the civil fine. And my understanding is that she is in the process of completing the CE right now.
So, Ms. Galvin, what are our options here? I mean, what is it to?
You can either grant her request to go inactive or deny her request to go inactive. If you grant her request to go inactive, she still has a license. You retain jurisdiction over her, and you can take disciplinary action if you feel that that's necessary based on the action in Alabama. You can also put in a provision if you grant her request to go inactive, that should she fail to renew her inactive status, if she were to reapply someday in the future, this issue would then be addressed at that time.
Okay.
The statute does not say a person who seeks inactive status must not be under investigation.
Question for attorney, please.
Okay.
Excuse me?
Question for attorney?
Yes.
Does granting her action give us the greatest level of control and supervision over her?
You would still retain jurisdiction, assuming she continues to renew her inactive license. If you deny her license or her request to go inactive, her license would just continue, and then she would perhaps choose not to renew it in the future. So either way, you have jurisdiction over, so long as she either renews her regular license or she renews her inactive.
And just for clarification to board members, her license was due for renewal on May 31st of this year.
And her request came in on the 6th of May?
Correct.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Flowers. So, given that information, then you would have more authority and retain jurisdiction over her if you grant her request to go inactive. Then you would retain jurisdiction over her.
All right, thank you, Ms. Galvin. Dr. Flowers?
Yes, in this situation, to me, it's not as clear-cut as I would like. And looking at her response to the difficulty she's had in Alabama, to me, she really minimized what was going on. She just said, it was no big deal. I didn't want to go through the hassle. You're just going to have me do some CEs and I'll be good. But I didn't see any kind of really acknowledgement of the fact that she gave an outdated test and that she was in a probationary status. You know, that's pretty public. You know, very likely if she were in Arizona, you know, she'd still be able to keep her license if she had done that kind of thing here. But on the other hand, we would be supervising compliance and so forth. So I'm not totally clear, you know, if we give her an active status, does that mean that she can just show she has CEs and she's able to just set up license and practice here in Arizona? You know, I'd like to see some kind of compliance and understanding on her part that this indeed is serious stuff. It is being addressed, but it's unacceptable.
Do Ms. Galvin, do we have jurisdiction to apply sanctions against someone because of something they did in another state that's already been addressed?
Being disciplined in another jurisdiction is an act of unprofessional conduct here. Mm-hmm. But she has not applied for renewal of her license, which expired a week or two ago. She is seeking an active status.
Okay.
And Madam Chair and board members, if her request to transition to inactive status is granted, should Dr. Kurtz seek reactivation of her license to active status in the future, that does have to be approved by the board. Board staff is not authorized to approve reactivation.
At that time, we can address any of these issues. All right.
This is Dr. Malott. Yeah.
Dr. Malott?
Yeah, since she's applying for inactive status, I think Dr. Flowers' statement that, she cannot practice here. The fact that she's going on inactive status, she is not putting the citizens of Arizona at risk because she is indicating that she's inactive. She still has to meet the conditions of the Alabama, the other board that has put on probation's orders, and that is between the board and her to meet whatever the probationary status requirements are. And at any time she chooses to come back and wants active status, we would need to review that she satisfactorily met the board probationary requirements and make a determination. Do we need to, you know, if we are satisfied with it, then we would let it go. If we are not satisfied and we think it was too weak, then, you know, we could open up, we could do our own review and make a determination. Am I on the right path, Ms. Galvin?
Yes. Are you making a motion, Dr. Malott?
Yeah, that we go ahead and accept her application for practice status.
All right, we have a motion. Is there a second?
Dr. Malott, as part of that motion, could you specify that should she fail to renew her inactive license and seek reapplication in the future, that this matter would be addressed at that time?
Yes.
I'll second that.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Aye. Hearing none, the motion carries. We have a 9 o'clock meeting. We have like 3 minutes to go. Is there anything we can do in a short period of time? I don't mind running over the nine if we have executive director.
Ms. Shreve, I'm going to recommend we do agenda item number 12. Dr. Melissa Flint is present, and she will speak to this request, but I can give you an introduction.
Thank you.
The chair of the Continuing Education Committee of the Arizona Psychological Association has submitted to the board a request for a 6-month extension of time for licensees to complete their continuing education. This would apply, the request applies to everyone with a license expiring in 2020. As you know, you previously approved a waiver permitting the executive director to approve continuing education deadline extension requests for up to 3 months from the date the declared emergency is lifted when the licensee submits a written explanation. Because we don't know when the emergency will be lifted, we can't predict what that 3-month extension, when that will conclude. So that is what we currently have in place, but the association is requesting, I think, something that is more broad than what the board originally had granted, or is potentially more broad. And so with that, I think Dr. Flint would be your best resource to explain this request and answer your questions.
Welcome, Dr. Flint. If you want to take your mute off, there you go, and provide us a summary of what you would like us to chat about.
Absolutely. So the Arizona Board, or the Arizona Psychological Association, has met regularly and is trying to keep our hand on the pulse of what's happening with some of the psychologists in our community. And there's been a pretty significant concern about CEs in light that two of the bigger events that normally happen in the fall, the APA ASPA convention, as well as the DV Ethics Day, are at minimum going to be electronic and or postponed. And that's where a lot of our psychologists get their continuing education credits. The CE committee also recognizes that everybody is in a, many people, I shouldn't say everybody, are in a state of a little bit of online fatigue, and that in recognition of that, allowing psychologists to have a bit more time to take care of their CEs on top of already being online for their practices might be a prudent and a very proactive approach. So that's the request of the CE committee at this time.
Dr. Bob.
Tammy, you're on mute.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Bob. Now you're on mute. Thank you.
I'll pop on and make a couple comments. We've had an incredibly challenging period. Practices, entire practices in some cases have gone electronic. And while our continuing education programs have gone electronic, at least the ones that I know I'm providing through my organization, access to those I think has been secondary to access to services and other things we've been trying to do. We've been in some extraordinary times. Sometimes it's extraordinary measures. I think the board, in working with the association, has a good little proposal here, and I would recommend that we accept it.
For clarification, can I ask, does this mean that psychologists would not file their applications for renewal until they get their continuing education, or would you still file your application for renewal and just seek a deferment on the CE, is what I'm guessing.
Dr. Flint, do you want to speak to that question?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was going to one of the members. Absolutely, I think people would continue to reapply and then just ask for the deferral on the CE if they happen to be in this spot where they're having some difficulty obtaining all the requirements.
So just to dismiss Dr. Flint, just so I'm kind of wrapping my head around this, you're required to do 40 CE credits in a 2-year period. If we allow them, if a person does 10 at renewal time, then their next 2-year period, they would have to do 50. 10 would be for the period they just passed, and then 40 would be for the next period. Am I understanding this right?
I'm not sure that the committee or the association thought through down to that detail. My assumption was that they would just apply for the continuation and that they would turn those in at some point during their renewal period rather than waiting and adding extra to the next period. I did not hear any conversation about that plan at all.
So if the person doesn't have the 40 credits at renewal, explain how that works then.
So we were asking that perhaps they would be able to submit their application and request the deferment of the CEs if this was approved, and then they would have additional time. The association was asking for a 6-month time extension to fulfill all of those CE requirements and turn them into the board.
Okay, but if you go with a 6-month extension, so we're allowing you to, what you're requesting is you apply, and 2 years have gone by and you're reapplying and you only have 30 credits, you're 10 short. You're asking that for 6 months, they can make up that 10 credits and go towards that year that just passed, but also they would need to do 40 in that next 2-year period to qualify for reapplication.
Yes, ma'am. I think everybody recognizes that they would still need to adhere to their non-crisis requirements once we get out of this COVID situation.
Okay, so we're still doing 40. There would still be 40 counted per year. You're just requesting that they can make up that extra that they didn't have ready when they renewed for 6 months, but they're still required to do 40 during that term.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understood this. Ms. Galvin?
Oh. I would like clarification. A 6-month extension from what? From the date of the renewal application, from the date that the state of emergency is lifted? Is this in addition to the 3 months the state has already granted?
It's my understanding that they are requesting that from the date of their renewal application, and that this just extends the period of time. The 3 months were already granted, but we're recognizing this is a bit longer of a process than any of us had hoped. So that 6 months would give people a little bit more time perhaps to coordinate getting all their CEs, particularly in this challenging online environment at times.
For those who just renewed, say that there's someone who's just renewed or in the last month or two, or that would apply then to the next renewal cycle. We could have an overlap of renewal cycles to which this would apply, and I'm just seeking clarification.
I'm not sure that they thought it down to that level. That is a great question, and if you would like me to get clarification from them, I certainly can.
Well, it's ultimately up for the board to decide how they're going to apply this.
Right. But Dr. Flint, we have to really look at it down to that level, because any decision we make has consequences either way. You know what
Absolutely.
I mean?
Absolutely.
So I need to make sure that we understand what if we make a decision, what are the consequences on the front end and the back end?
I'm understanding it that it hits the renewal cycle in which the executive order is given a 3-month, and we're simply extending that out to a 6-month because it makes sense to do so. So if we go from the time that someone's renewal is due and attack on 6 months of good faith then I think that's what we're being asked to do.
Okay. Are there any concerns? Do I hear a motion? Any other comments from the board?
This is Dr. Meyer.
Dr. Meyer?
What kind of burden would this be on staff, and how much extra work would it be to track all of this?
Good question. Executive Director, thoughts?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you for posing the question, Dr. Meyer. You know, we'll have to take a look at that. We do have some latitude within our system to make some modifications. Some of this may have to be, you know, more of a manual process. So it's harder to change requirements than it is to essentially waive requirements. So if this is the board's decision, then we'll implement it in the best way that we can. We'll make it happen.
Okay, so what we have is a request to extend the 3 months to 6 months. Are there any other comments?
I'd move we do it.
Okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. We are now going to go to our timed item. Item number 7, informal interview of Shauna Sade, PhD, complaint number 2014. The time now is 9:08 on June 5th. This is an informal interview of Dr. Shauna Sade, case number 2014. Dr. Sade, are you present?
Dr. Sade is present with her counsel. My name is Mark Harrison.
Let me just continue, and then I'll definitely have you. So, Dr. Sade, you're here. If you'd like to take your phone off mute and just, yes, you are?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. And you are represented by legal counsel?
Yes.
Thank you. And legal counsel, now can you introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you. Forgive me, I'm not sure I'd be able to identify members of the board by name, even if I were in the room, but certainly in this dystopian situation, I'm having trouble identifying people in the pictures. My name is Mark Harrison, and my colleague Travis Hunt will also be involved in the course of this interview. I want to make a brief record with the board's permission.
We'll get to that in just a minute. I have a process I have to do.
Okay.
So I'm gonna stick with that so I don't get in trouble here. I'm Ms. Shreve. I'm the chair of the board, and I need all the other members to please introduce yourselves.
Dr. Bob Bohansky, psychology member.
Chair, if the members would raise their hand when they introduce themselves, it would really be helpful to those of us sitting several miles away.
I'm the chair, Tammy Shreve. Dr. Bob is on the phone.
Yes, Dr. Bob Bohansky, psychologist member.
Dr. Matt Meyer, psychology member.
Brian Davey, behavior analyst member.
Steve Gill, psychologist member.
Yeah. Lynn Flower, psychologist member.
Diana Davis Wilson, behavior analyst member.
And I believe Dr. Diner, or Mr. Diner, are you on the phone? And Dr. Malott?
Dr. Malott notified me that she needed to step out of the meeting for just a moment. She'll return shortly.
Okay. All right. This proceeding is being audio taped, so everyone must speak loudly and clearly and only one person at a time. And I must actually step back and apologize. We also have with us Ms. Galvin, who is our attorney from the Attorney General's office. She's with us here.
Good morning.
In this matter. You've been noticed of the matters to be discussed today and the possible actions of the board that we may take in this informal interview. The purpose of this informal interview is to inquire into the facts and the circumstances of the case. Board members have read all the material and additional submissions. If it is necessary to refer to clients or patients during the interview, please do so only by initials. We will read the allegations from the informal interview notice, and then we will interview you. If present, the complainant may address the board after we interview the licensee. So the licensee will be first, and then will be followed by the complainant. In complaint number 2014, it is alleged that you engaged in unprofessional conduct, including but not limited to possible violations of the following: ARS 32-2061-H-16-H for failing or refusing to maintain and retain adequate business and financial or professional records pertaining to the psychological services provided to a client or patient, and ARS 32-2061-16-O for providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice, and ARS 32-2061-16-DD for violating an ethical standard adopted by the board. I am now going to swear you in. Do you swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, Dr. Sade?
Yes.
Thank you. All right. This is the interview part for Dr. Sade. Dr. Sade, did you review the records in this case in preparation for your appearance here today?
Yes.
And do you or your legal counsel wish to make an opening comments?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to reiterate my view that it would be desirable to have this interview in executive session because information will inevitably come out that is not, should not be publicly accessible. The evidence will confirm that a complainant MP is the subject of a pending DCS investigation and report, that she is the subject of a pending criminal investigation by the Scottsdale Police Department, and as a result, her credibility and the credibility of her allegations are very much in question. Dr. Sade has been specifically asked by the Scottsdale Police Department if she will testify in the ongoing criminal investigation. I have asked your very, very able counsel, Jean Galvin, twice to have the board obtain for its review and consideration a report from the mother's therapist, Lauren Day, and the DCS report, and I have been told that the board has refused to get those materials. They bear directly on the credibility of the complainant and on her allegations against Dr. Sade. And it is my view, based on a fair amount of experience before this board, that the failure to obtain and consider these reports is highly prejudicial. So I'm hereby renewing my request that the board obtain these reports. If the board dismisses the complaint today, then there's no need to get them. If it doesn't, it should defer a decision until those reports can be obtained and reviewed by the board. I would add, if you will permit me, I've represented more than 20 psychologists before this board, dating back to when Maxine McCarthy was the executive director. Most of those complaints, like this one, arose out of very high conflict divorce cases. This case is without a doubt the most complicated, difficult case I have been associated with or seen. The evidence provided by professionals will show without question that Dr. Sade is an able, highly ethical, and competent psychologist who navigated the troubled waters in this case with the utmost professionalism. It will show that she voluntarily, in reaction to the board's expressed concerns, took a number of CE courses dealing with record keeping. The only witness who disagrees with this assessment of Dr. Sade's performance is the complainant. The others, Drs. Mellon and Cahill, are highly trained, very experienced psychologists who believe her performance was able, professional, and competent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, I think Mr. Harrison has put forth a couple of oral motions, and the first one being, again, that the board issue a subpoena with respect to mother's mental health records. I think that needs to be addressed. And then his second request is to hold these proceedings in executive session. So I would ask the board to consider his request at this time, because your decision on one or both of them could impact how we proceed.
There are some issues that I don't think are that are more administrative in nature, the record keeping, the question about the letter that came from paradigm that was supposed to go to the judge. I mean, there's some that are not executive, I don't think are executive session. They're not someone's, they're not mental health or HIPAA type of issues. In regards to the subpoena for the mother's mental health, I guess any thoughts or comments from the board members on this?
Madam Chair?
Dr. Flowers.
Yes, I think looking at all the issues here, a lot of it has to do with record keeping and services that were provided and billed and so on. I don't know that we need to seek records on the complainant. It sounds as if the attorney would like to impeach her credibility, but I think we can take action simply on the information provided in writing, as well as the testimonies given.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Dr. Bob?
Yes,
sir. Despite the fact that I don't go back nearly to McCarthy eras, I have been around the barn a few times, and I agree with Dr. Flower.
No.
All right. If you're, please put your phone on mute if you're not speaking. All right. So I think at this point, do we need a, Ms. Galvin, do we need to deny a motion, or do we just, or would it, or do I need to take a vote about the subpoena? I need a little...
Yes, I would prefer that a motion to either issue a subpoena for the records or to deny a request for the subpoena of the records.
All right, is there a motion?
Madam Chair, I so move that the request be denied.
Okay, we have a motion.
With respect to the subpoena.
With respect to the subpoena for records on the complainant.
Okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
Second, Dr. Bob.
All right, we have a motion and a second. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. All right, and Ms. Galvin, the second issue?
His second request appears to be one that would require the board to carry out these proceedings in executive session. My advice to the board at this time would be that at the outset, there appears to be no reason at this time to adjourn into executive session. There are only very few limited reasons to adjourn into executive session, and none are present at this time. If we get into an area that requires the board to go into executive session, I will certainly notify the board at that time.
Thank you.
Then let's play it by ear as we proceed. If there should be a cause for something to arise that requires executive session, we will be noticed and take a appropriate vote.
All right. Ms. Galvin, do we need to have a vote on his request?
No.
Okay. Just want to thank you. Thanks. Just want to make sure I'm staying on the right path. I am the lead board member of this case. I'm going to provide a summary of the case. This complainant stems from a custody proceeding regarding MP, mom, and TP, father, and their daughter, RP. TP filed for divorce in September of 2018, and they have been engaged in ongoing custody battles since then. On January 2019, the court appointed Dr. Carol Manel Sedale as a therapeutic interventionalist, and Dr. Sade was working in conjunction with Dr. Melon Sedale. Dr. Sade began providing therapy to the daughter on March 2019. July 2019, daughter was hospitalized in a residential mental health facility, Paradigm, and was discharged on August 19th, and was court ordered to live with dad. On July 2019, dad was given sole legal custody and decision-making for daughter. On September 19, the board received mother's claim, which was subsequently sent to three board members for review. Two of the reviewers recommended that a complaint be opened. A mother alleges the following: general bias and unethical and unprofessional behavior by Dr. Sade regarding her treatment of daughter. According to daughter, Dr. Sade vocalized threats to daughter on several occasions regarding being sent away to boarding school or foster care or mental health or inpatient treatment if daughter did not spend time with dad. Dr. Sade blame mom for daughter's BMI low, dropping so low that daughter would have to be hospitalized with a feeding tube and was at risk of failure. Dr. Sade planned to accompany daughter on a shopping trip to buy new furniture for daughter's bedroom at father's house. Dr. Sade offered to assist daughter with mass patient from her parents once daughter turned 16. Dr. Sade shared very personal information with daughter regarding Dr. Sade's blind dates and online
very
dates.
Scary.
Please turn your phone on mute if you are listening in. Dr. Sade invited daughter to attend a team group which was led by Coach Ben Miller. Coach Miller would give daughter massages during the sessions. Mother later learned that Coach Miller was Dr. Sade's then boyfriend. Coach Miller discontinued the group, and Dr. Sade told daughter they broke up and he left the group to become a massage therapist. Dr. Sade accompanied daughter and dad to a doctor's appointment with daughter's general practitioner. Daughter was forced to change schools at the recommendation of Dr. Sade. Dr. Sade informed daughter that he had been Dr. Sade reported dad that he had been reported to adult protection services by mom. Dr. Sade failed to share all details and facts with other providers and school therapists. That Dr. Sade did not submit to the presiding judge, the medical director of Paradigm Malibu, letter that was sent to them to provide to the judge. The licensee, and then there was a lot of backup submissions from the complainant. Dr. Sade did provide a timely response. Dr. Sade stated she worked in conjunction with Dr. Sadell, with whom she shares an office. Dr. Melon Sadell was court appointed in a therapeutic interventionalist for the family and sought assistance of Dr. Sade to provide individual therapy to daughter. Dr. Sade found daughter appeared younger than her age of 14 at the time and was underweight. Dr. Sade learned that daughter was extremely anxious, not only because of divorce proceedings, but because of her conceptions about long-standing health problems that the doctor could not seem to diagnose or treat, that doctors could not seem to diagnose or treat. Dr. Sade initially recommended to Dr. Melon Sadell that the family court and the family court that there should be no attempts to reunification between daughter and dad. In May 19, Dr. Sadell determined it would be appropriate to initiate unification between father and daughter. In two of the five therapy sessions, Coach Miller, therapy assistant, attended with the parents' permission. Due to concerns with mother exhibiting health issues, Dr. Sade reported mom to the Arizona Department of Child Safety and for this and other possible issues that she felt mother might have. Daughter's records were subsequently reviewed by Janet Cahill, a psychologist who treats patients that have health issues that was maybe thought mother may have. Then Dr. Cahill's determined that Dr. Sade's conduct in this matter is ethically sound and clinically appropriate. Dr. Sade initially determined that daughter had made significant progress in her mental health and physical health while there, but by late July 2019, there were disagreements concerning daughter's treatment plan between the Arizona care team and the Paradigm team. Daughter was discharged from Paradigm on August 2019, and then on June 2019, court ordered daughter to live with father, and he was granted sole decision-making custody. Dr. Sade and her responses address all of the complaints that were brought up by the complainant. Dr. Sade again asserts that the complaint was filed due to a high conflict divorce proceedings, This had went to the board, and I've already read what the charges were from the board. So that concludes my summary. Dr. Sade, you did Did you review all the records in the case for the proceedings? I already asked you that. We will now proceed with the questions of Dr. Sade.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes.
We have questions we'd like to present before you question Dr. Sade, because it comes the witness's schedule, if the board will permit us. Dr. Cahill is not in Phoenix, and she's an expert who you referred to in your summary. And I'd like to question her first, if the board will permit me to do so.
Ms. Galvin?
You may do that. Do they have an opening statement first? His opening statement before was more of a procedural question. Is there another opening statement that you would like to make, Mr. Harrison or Dr. Sade?
I can make a very brief 2-minute opening statement that may repeat some of what I already said, but the only evidence before this board, other than the records and the complainant's complaint, which raises any questions, is the complainant's complaint. And as I suggested in my initial request for the issuance of subpoenas, the complainant's complaint is very much subject to her credibility, and it is not, frankly, worthy of a lot of attention or belief. The only witnesses who have reviewed this file and the licensee's conduct are highly trained psychologists who believe her conduct was ethical, professional, and competent. So the only issues raised by the board when I reviewed its minutes from the last meeting related to record keeping, primarily related to record keeping and billing. And as I indicated previously, the licensee has, Dr. Sade has voluntarily on her own initiative taken several CE courses dealing with record keeping. And the circumstances of this case did not really suggest when a treatment plan as such would be provided in the file, but she now makes that a routine part of her handling of cases. I think, with all due respect to the board, there is no evidence and will be no evidence that would justify any discipline in this case. I'd like to have Dr. Cahill as our first witness so we can accommodate her schedule with the board's permission.
My preference would be to talk to Dr. Cahill first, because I like to, again, what is it at the end of the day, what are the issues that we need to go into? Unless Dr. Cahill is this about what is her testimony about the mother?
Her testimony is about the fact that she reviewed all of the records and has opinions about the licensee's conduct. And also has opinions about what the records reflect on the part of the complainant.
All right, we'll go ahead and allow Dr. Cahill. Are you on the line?
I think we've got to get her on the line. Where is it?
She'll need to be sworn in, Ms. Shreve.
Yeah, excuse me for just a moment. I've got to get my colleague and find out how we're going to get her on the line. These virtual meetings are a little challenging for somebody my age. I wish I had grown up with computers and this sort of thing, but my grandchildren are much better at this than I am.
Yeah. Is she joining us by phone?
Hi, this is Travis Hunt. I have sent a message to her to join. She has responded that she's working on it at the moment.
All right. Thank you. Because we'd like to continue.
Is she going to be on in a minute, Travis?
That's what she's indicated, yes.
Okay. I apologize for the delay, and I appreciate your indulgence.
Dr. Bob has a quick question.
Dr. Bob, please.
The records were reviewed by the psychologist we're about to question. Why?
Because the issues in the case raise questions that are uniquely within her field of expertise. She's a nationally recognized expert in the field of factitious disorder, MVP, and given the fact that the license...
Okay, we can't use diagnosis, and I understand that that's one of the problems with
executive I should mention I'm here.
She is not... She didn't make any clinical assessments. She can't testify because she hasn't interviewed any of the active parties, but she did review the records. And so with your permission, I'll question her.
Again, the one question I have, and I appreciate doctor's credentials and background and strength and the rest of it. Was she brought into this case by Dr. Sissel's group to review the records? Was she brought into this case by the court to review these records? How is it that she finds herself as a fact witness, or even more importantly, an opinion witness at this point in time?
She was brought, with all due respect, doctor, she was brought into this case by me to serve as an expert witness to provide an opinion.
Thank you. That's all I needed to know.
All right. Ms. Cahill, Dr. Cahill.
I'm here. Can you all hear me and see me?
I can. I'm waving at you. My name's Tammy Shreve. I'm the chair. I need to swear you in.
Sure.
So you swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
I do.
All right, there'll be some questions from Dr. Sade's attorney, and then the board may have questions following that.
Of course.
Thank you, ma'am. Go ahead. Please state your full name for the record.
Janet Cahill.
Tell the board briefly about your experience and your credentials and your educational background.
I am a clinical psychologist. I was a professor and chair of the psychology department at Rowan University for many years. I've also, in terms of my clinical practice, specialized in child protection. And as part of that, I predominantly do training on evidence-based practice, and I do parental capacity evaluations for child protective services. Over the course of my career, I think I've done over 3,000 parental capacity evaluations for various agencies. And in the pursuit of that, I have been referred a number of cases where there is some concern that it might meet the criteria for what I'm going to use is the term for this.
We can't do any diagnoses on, we're in a public meeting. So
I'm just saying that you're asking my credentials. I'm giving my credentials. In no way, shape, or form am I going to make any clinical recommendations in this case.
Okay. Or
Madam Chair, I indicated at the beginning that Dr. Cahill has not evaluated any of the parties to this and isn't going to make any diagnosis. She's going to talk about issues implicated by the records. That's it.
If the record is saying that a certain person may have a certain diagnosis or anything, or you might think that, we just can't say that in public, in a public meeting. Ms. Cahill, can you, am I going down the right road here? I just want to make sure it's clear, that we're clear on how it.
Yeah, I ethically cannot say a single thing about someone I haven't met. So that's
perfect.
I'm just giving you a history. We don't have to do this about where I ended up getting expertise in FTIA in general.
However, let me interject, Madam Chair. This is precisely why I suggested it would be appropriate to have this in executive session. When she talked about these issues, to the extent that they arguably relate to the complainant, it wouldn't be a problem.
Ms. Galvin?
I think I just did that.
Ms. Shreve, I would recommend that Dr. Cahill be allowed to finish telling the board about her credentials and we move on. And just a reminder to the board that this matter involves Dr. Sade and her treatment of the patient and not the diagnosis or lack thereof of mother or anyone else participating.
I ever put a Zoom background on his computer of ASU.
Oh, that's hysterical.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
That's all I would say is that I've had a number of cases and I have expertise in factitious disorder in person and other. I think that's all you need to hear about my credentials at this point.
In general terms, doctor, what is FDIA, what you referred to as FDIA. Please, the board may well know.
Ms. Galvin.
Mr. Harrison, that is not relevant at this point, in my opinion. I would ask that you keep your questions related to Dr. Sade's treatment of her patients.
With all due respect, Madam Chair, that is at the heart of this case, the very heart of this case. And to suggest it's not relevant is really baffling to me. That's what this case is all about. And I would again ask the doctor to explain what is understood to me he meant by FDIA.
I would ask the board to weigh in whether they want this line of questioning to proceed.
I have concerns with, you know, the complaint. It has a complaint. We're looking at the complaint. Does it have merit? And not whether does the complainant have a certain issue or not. I think we're looking at the merit of the complaint and the evidence of the complaint.
Mark, can I say
something? So, does someone else want to weigh in? Any thoughts, Dr. Flowers? You look like you're going to.
Yes, I'm very concerned because I think if this is a diversion of the real issue, certainly, you know, if they would like to try to impeach the complainant, I guess they may. But I'm focused on the actual treatment, paperwork, diagnosis, and so forth that was rendered or not rendered. From what I understand, reading what Dr. Cahill presented, you know, that is in our records, what I could tell from that is she felt that a referral to Child Protective Services was appropriate.
Yeah.
I don't think she said that the record keeping, the billing, and the treatment plan and so forth were acceptable. She was just saying, yes, there was reason to make a referral for Child Protective Services. Okay, that's good. I don't think that's the issue here.
Dr. Bob, I'm going to agree with Dr. Flower. We have an expert who's reviewed the records, who's reviewed the treatment received by this child in a nasty custody situation. If she wants to opine on her review of those records, I would be most interested in hearing her opinion as to whether this case was handled properly. If she wants to opine on another matter unrelated to that complaint, then I have some concerns.
Madam Chair, members of the board, my client, the licensee, is a direct victim of the conduct of the complainant. And the conduct is clearly pertinent to the whole issue of FDIA. And unless the board understands that and recognizes how it relates to this complaint, it's missing the point in my judgment, with all due respect.
May I say something more?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I understand how it could appear as a diversion at this point. It's not. I was treating a suspected victim of FDIA.
Which the mother's suspected condition
greatly impacted issues of consent, record keeping, and all of the core issues that you are concerned about. So if you forbid me from being able to discuss the impact of mother's condition on the victim who I was treating, that is a significant, I mean, I have no chance.
So are you saying that because of the parents' situation that affects your record keeping?
Absolutely.
Of course.
I had to give two different updates to the parents because I was afraid that if I said certain things to the mother, the child would be harmed.
All right. I need some weigh in here from some of the board members. Your thoughts?
This is Dr. Gill. I would like for Dr. Cahill to complete her summary of the case without interruption.
And that necessarily includes a discussion of what are the typical signs and indicia of FDIA. Go ahead, Doctor.
But this is Dr. Malott. I think maybe we do need to go into executive session. I think the complainant and the expert that they brought have the right to share their information with us. And I don't want to feel like we are preventing them the ability to share the information.
All right.
I would just like to say one thing, just so I'm super, super clear. I can only discuss the FCIA in terms of what it is, not whether or not it occurred in this case. I can't make any diagnostic conclusions. I can only explain the current best practice standards for FDIA. So I just want to be super clear about that.
And it's my understanding, Doctor, you can explain that Dr. Sade complied with those best practice standards, correct?
In my opinion, she did.
Now, it would be helpful to the board, in my view, if you explained what FDIA is or what guidelines are implicated if there is suspected FDIA, even though you obviously didn't make a diagnosis.
Go ahead, Doctor. Go ahead.
So I'm doing what I'm supposed to do here. You want me to say what explain the current best practice standards for FDIA? Is that correct?
First explain what it is.
And again, I'm saying this in the abstract. This information is based on two major sources. One is the DSM-5 current criteria for this disorder, and the other is from the APSEC, the American Professional Society on the Abuse of Children, has released in 2017 very, very thorough best practice standards for what a psychologist and other mental health professionals or child protection professionals are supposed to do if they suspect that that may be a factor in a case that they're dealing with. So those, the DSM-5 obviously is there, you can read it. And the APSEC standards are on their website, and I'm making my statements about this based on those two sources, plus my own clinical experience with these cases over the years. So hopefully that's clear to everyone. So factitious disorder imposed on the other is the diagnostic term in that applies to psychologists. That's the one in the DSM-5. This disorder has an alphabet soup of other things that it's called. It's called Munchausen by proxy. It's called child medical neglect. It's called abuse by pediatric condition falsification. But it all rides around the same diagnostic criteria and leads to the same treatment and behavior on the part of professionals who are involved in these cases. So the core, and these things have changed fairly recently over the last couple of years. The best practice guidelines are much, much more specific, and diagnostic criteria is much, much more specific than it's been in the past. So the core of factitious disorder imposed by another is that it is a pattern of deliberate deception that affects children in the care of that caregiver, and the deliberate, exaggeration of symptoms, so it can take a number of forms. It can take an existing condition and exaggerate it. It can, the alleged perpetrator could also be making up symptoms and fabricating those. But the core of it is that it's a deliberate deceptive pattern of exaggerating, fabricating, simulating, or inducement symptoms in a child in their care.
Do your guidelines, do the FDIA guidelines urge what is referred to as a separation test?
So yes, that is part of the best practice protocol. If there is sufficient—
Bring that to the board and what it involves and why.
Okay. So in terms of this particular syndrome or this particular disorder, if there is credible evidence of concerns, and the psychologist is involved in this, first they should make sure that if they are not trained in this, they should ask for professional advice. My understanding is that in this case, Brenda Birch, who's a very well-known national expert, was consulted. There appeared to be enough criteria for the possibility. That doesn't mean it is or isn't, it's just a possible diagnosis. In that case, the psychologists, because we're mandated reporters, must report this to CPS. We really don't have a choice about that. I believe that was occurred, and they did not pick up the case at that point. So that part of it is part of the protocol. And then if there's sufficient credibility for the possible diagnosis of this, and there are other things that it could be, then part of the diagnostic protocol is a separation test. And this is different from virtually any other psychological concern we have in mental health regarding parental functioning. Usually in child protection, we try our absolute best to make sure that the parent has ongoing contact with the child, even if we have concerns about abuse and neglect. And it might be that they can visit in the home, and it might be they have supervised visits. But very rarely do we cut off completely the contact between the caregiver and the child, except in FDIA, because the separation test is a necessary piece of the protocol for diagnostic purposes. And in the separation test, if you look at the ASSET guideline, it says that the child should be placed in a situation away from the alleged perpetrator. They should not have any contact with them of any kind, if that's possible, and they should not have any control over their medical, behavioral, educational needs. That separation test usually lasts as long as we would expect to see the symptoms that have been identified by the caregiver. So, for example, if the child has a seizure disorder and the caregiver says they have seizures every day, we would expect to see seizures every day in the separation test. And we would, if they only have them every couple of weeks, we would leave that separation test for a couple of weeks to see if those symptoms occur. Generally speaking, if in separation tests, if the child, for example, does start to have seizures every day, or clearly that tells us that this is not FDIA, the separation test would be stopped, and we'd move on to other possible diagnoses or concerns. In many cases, though, when the separation occurs, we see an almost instantaneous improvement in the part of the child. There are no seizures. There's no vomiting. They can eat a sandwich without any problems. They don't seem to need anything. They don't have allergies. They don't have this. They don't have that. And that would then trigger a much more thorough and complete protocol that's in the ABSAT guidelines about how we would then formally decide if this meets the criteria for FDIA or not.
Did your review of the records indicate that the people at the residential treatment center understood this and understood the need for separation?
I can't speak to that. I haven't met those folks or talked to those folks.
You're aware that Dr. Sade has been asked to take more cases from DCS involving suspected medical child abuse?
Yes, I am aware of that.
And what does that suggest to you about Dr. Sade's qualifications and ability?
Well, I'm assuming the CPS folks in Arizona see her as being an effective professional in this regard. It's hard to find people who will take on these cases. They're very complex and very, very difficult. So there's not that many people who do these sorts of things.
And
I would say one thing in general terms about whether or not the professional makes that conclusion. Under no circumstances in this protocol should a professional, and this is my understanding of what happened, and if I'm wrong, tell me, no professional should ever make the diagnosis of or reject FDIA. So either you say they have it or they don't, by only contacting sources that are put forward by the possible perpetrator. That the protocol for this requires a much, much more rigorous and extensive review of all the records before you'd either rule it in or rule it out.
It's my understanding that following your review of Dr. Sade's records, you concluded that she faithfully followed the ABSAC guidelines and acted competently and ethically in the handling of this matter. Is that correct?
As it regards to the possible diagnosis of FDIA, yes.
1 minute, please. Yeah. Do the records you reviewed reflect the fact that at some point Paradigm wanted the mother to be in contact with the daughter?
I did see that, yes.
And that would be if FDIA is suspected.
I don't think, Ms. Galvin, I don't think we want to correlate a diagnosis with the person here.
Ms.
Galvin?
I wasn't trying to correlate the diagnosis with the person.
It sounded like it.
I apologize. I simply wanted to ask the witness if the residential treatment center people wanted to put mother and daughter in contact, would that be contrary to the FDIA guidelines?
But then you're assuming that the mother has an issue. I want to be careful here. Ms. Galvin, any thoughts here?
I would agree. We're speaking to Dr. Cahill about this condition in very general terms, and I don't want there to be any correlation between what the treatment center may have done with respect to mom and child and that relationship based on a condition that Dr. Cahill has not opined whether anyone has that condition.
It's a fair point. Let me rephrase the question, Madam Chair. Dr. Cahill, if a patient were subject to the separation test under the FDIA guidelines, would reuniting that patient with the suspected abuser violate the guidelines?
Yes.
Just one moment. I'm not sure. You're aware of the fact, Doctor, that in this case, based on your review of the records, Dr. Sade was functioning as part of a team with a therapeutic interventionist, a therapist for the mother, therapist from the father. You're aware of that, aren't you?
Yes.
And do the records reflect that her treatment decisions were a manifestation of a team effort or a team consultation?
I think that's too broad a question for me to answer from my role in this. I can't really tell you, I can't really give an opinion about the overall treatment for the treatment.
As I recall, I don't have your report right in front of me, but as I recall, you said in your report that suspected abusers in cases involving FDIA are typically manipulative. Is that true?
That is true.
And so if a suspected abuser were trying to splinter professionals involved in the case, would that be a manifestation of that kind of manipulation?
I can say in general terms that when we look at the characteristics of individuals who meet the criteria for this, and we should never ever make a diagnosis of FDIA based on those profiles. It is generally agreed in the field that individuals with this disorder, and it's in the APSIDE guidelines actually, that they will frequently attempt to splinter different people, different providers in order to support their position. But I can only say that in general terms.
I understand. Thank you, Doctor. I have nothing further.
Board members, do you have any questions for Dr. Cahill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Dr. Flowers.
Yes, I appreciate your expertise on the topics that you mentioned. I don't think that we're trying to say you don't have them. But I guess the key issue, you've spoken in general terms that from what I can tell.
Dr. Flowers, I can't hear you.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me better now?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Okay. I'll try to talk in front rather than to my side. But I'm wondering, indeed, that it appears that a referral to CPS was appropriate. I think you've addressed that. But I guess you've also not really specifically said if you reviewed things such as treatment plans, intake procedures, services provided for therapy and so forth are appropriate. Is that correct?
That is correct. With the exception of the separation test, because I do think that was appropriate. That okay. would follow the guidelines.
So basically to ensure the safety of the child.
Correct.
The yeah. CPS issues, but as far as how she treated, managed, treatment plans and all that, you didn't get to that specificity.
I'm not able to make those kinds of recommendations okay. or endorsements, yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions for Dr. Cahill?
Dr. Meyer. Thank you, Dr. Cahill, for your time and input. My question is, do the guidelines you referred to in dealing with these conditions provide any guidance on documentation? I guess, are there exceptions to how this work should be documented that would be any different than the standard requirements for documentation? So treatment notes, progress notes, treatment plans, things like that.
So it depends on the role of the professional. So in my role, I'm usually the evaluator. And yes, there's for the evaluator, the person who will ultimately make or reject the diagnosis, either rule it in or rule it out. We have a very specific protocol of how we would record what's going on. So it would have to do with the medical records, the psychological records, et cetera. In terms of treatment, once the diagnosis is made, there are also specific protocols that are called for. However, in the process before that, in the normative process of whatever the clinician is doing who is not the evaluator, the guidelines don't speak to that. Does that make sense?
Yes. There's nothing that says you would not include information in records, that you would withhold information.
The best practice guidelines for FCIA do not speak to those, the things you just said. They don't speak to that. They speak to the diagnostic and then the treatment process if that diagnosis is confirmed.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Dr. Cahill?
This is Dr. Gill. Thank you, Dr. Cahill, for being here. Just a follow-up question to Dr. Meyer. Would it be appropriate in a case where the therapist was discontinued the treatment, would it be appropriate for a discharge summary to be included as part of the medical record?
Again, you know, in my role here, most is speaking about the FDA. I don't have an opinion on that, and the guidelines that I'm talking to you about do not speak to that. I mean, there's general guidelines in the APA, which I'm sure you're aware of, but that doesn't relate to the FDIA. I will say one thing about FDIA that is relevant is it becomes chaotic. If that's what's really going on or there's some concern about it, then the case becomes extremely difficult to manage. So I'll say that, but there's no specific advice from those guidelines to what you asked.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Just one, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I don't want to interfere with board members who have questions. Dr. Cahill, based on your review of Dr. Sade's records, did you find them complete and informative, given the fact that these are difficult, chaotic cases?
Well, I did not review her clinical records, so I can't speak to that. And I shouldn't in this role. Either.
You did a summary of the case, I take it.
Well, I did see the summary of the case, yes, but that I haven't seen her specific records, so I have no opinion on that.
Okay, are there any other questions? Dr. Cahill, thank you for attending today. We do appreciate your testimony and you being here today.
Thank you, Dr. Cahill.
You're quite welcome.
Yeah, we appreciate it. We're going to now move to Dr. Sade. Dr. Sade, you're
starting. A two-minute restroom break, please.
Okay, let's take a 5-minute comfort break. Does that work for everybody? So please
yes.
put your phone or your Zoom on mute. Possibly, you know, you can also undo your video if your stream if you'd like. And we will be back here at 5 minutes after the hour. executive director?
I think that based upon everyone's appearance on Zoom, Ms. Poe or Ms. Peckinen can determine who is present. Doesn't look like Mr. Dr. Flowers is back yet.
No, there's Dr. Millott. Okay, everybody's now switched. So where I was used to looking at your face is now at a different point.
Dr. Bob is here.
All right. Okay. It looks like we are all back. Welcome back. All right. We were just going to now focus our questioning to Dr. Sade. Dr. Sade, you're still sworn in?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. And then I'd like to open it to the board for any questions.
Are we going to do a statement?
Oh, I thought your attorney made a statement, but yes, go ahead if you'd like to make a statement.
Mark?
Well, I frankly want to question Dr. Sade, but I can do it before or after the board questions her.
Galvin, is there a...
I would go ahead and let Mr. Harrison go ahead and question Dr. Sade.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Harrison.
Thank you. Chair. Dr. Sade, just so the board is aware of it, tell them briefly about your background, where you got your degrees, your practice, and your license.
I am a graduate of the University of Minnesota School Psychology Program.
Dr. Sade, are you there?
I can't hear her.
Dr. Sade, are you on mute?
Ms. Sheep, I think more people need to be on mute other than Dr. Sade, because there's a lot of people unmuted. And I think Ms. Bo has the ability to mute people, since she's the host, so I would encourage her to do that.
Ms. Poe, if you could handle that. Dr. Sade, could you please speak up? Dr. Sade, are you there? Mr. Hunt, can you hear us? I know you're at the law firm.
Yes, I'm at the law firm. I can't hear her either. Shauna, do you... can you get closer to the microphone? Or is the microphone on mute?
Is it on mute?
Krishna, is this muting on our end?
I attempt to unmute her, but it just goes back to mute. So it's something in her settings.
Is this better?
We are in the same room.
True. Mark, can you speak?
Hello.
All right. Can you switch places with Dr. Sade? We just need to be able to speak to Dr. Sade.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. We had accidentally hit mute on our speaker. Mark and I are in the same room. We're just social distance.
Okay. That's fine. We just want to move on with it. So if Dr. Sade, go ahead.
So I earned a PhD from the University of Minnesota, completed my APIC pre-doctoral and postdoctoral internships here in Scottsdale, obtained licensure in 2017, and developed my own private practice. I became introduced to the field of forensic psychology through Dr. Mellon, who has practiced in that area for many decades, and began providing services, court-informed, court-involved services. I treat children. I specialize in trauma treatment in high-conflict divorce. So my reputation in family court is very important. Any action by this board would greatly influence my credibility as an expert witness and ability to provide those services.
Have you been appointed by the court to serve as a PI or otherwise in contested divorce cases?
Yes.
Did you help found a nonprofit with Dr. Sylvia Cohn that provides treatment to children?
Yes, Dr. Cohn and I founded a nonprofit to make high quality evaluations for children more affordable in the Valley area.
In what role did you become involved in the case which led to the complaint pending before the board?
Dr. Mellon had been appointed as the therapeutic interventionist and had an order to reunite the child with her estranged father. Dr. Mellon experienced a lot of resistance in that process and recognized the need for the child to have an individual therapist. Dr. Mellon recommended to the parents that I provide that treatment because of my expertise in the area of high conflict divorce and trauma. Parents met with me, both were excited and consented. Mother believed that the treatment would was appropriate because of her belief that the family had experienced domestic violence. So trauma treatment seemed appropriate. Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, tell the board briefly how the case evolved in your therapy for the child.
These cases are very complicated because parents tend to have different realities. It's very frequent that mother thinks the house was blue and dad thinks the house was green, and then a child is trapped in between. So it is prudent and necessary to proceed very cautiously in deciding how to treat the case. In this particular case, there was an additional issue of the child's medical history. When she presented to me, she was extremely impaired and preoccupied about her body and its health and her health and her belief that basically nobody could help her due to her long history of medical treatment that was ineffective. She was very, very thin. She had fear of leaving her home. She was unable to engage in most typical teenage activities. When considering how to start treatment in these complex cases, I hire a consultant to just help get another fresh pair of eyes on the case and help me prioritize treatment. In this case, I have had a practice of hiring Lauren Day, paid her about $185, $150 an hour, to review my cases with me. She'd help me with, 15 to 20 different cases.
What was Lauren Day's specialty? Why did you reach out to her and pay her with your own funds to help you better serve the child?
Lauren Day is an exceptional provider. She specializes in EMDR training, so trauma treatment, dissociative disorders, eating disorders, and she also has experience in the area of Munchausen by proxy, treating it. So she's one of those practitioners who really gets curious about and interested in complicated cases instead of shying away from them. And we have that in common. So as somebody who practices with very complicated cases, I ensure a lot of safeguards to make sure that my work is high quality, because it is very easy to get off track or to cause damage, even though my intention is to help. We agreed that targeting medical issues was an appropriate first target because it didn't hit the controversial issues of family dynamics that the parents were alleging. Father had alleged Munchausen by proxy. Mother had alleged domestic violence. We didn't want to go there. The child responded very quickly to treatment, much faster than I would have expected, and was able to, after treatment of about a couple of weeks, able to start having positive memories about Father again. Was able to start recognizing that her body could be healthy and healing. And these changes were so significant because they differed from what mother believed. And their relationship was incredibly enmeshed. Child would tell me things like, I don't know how I feel until mother tells me how I feel. Because I said, you know, how will we know when our work together is done? She would get better in session and then lose it when she left. She could not hold on to those good feelings. And she said to me, it's too painful to feel better here and then go home and lose it and have it all come back. So this dynamic of having to maintain the mother-child relationship, because mother was the only caregiver that really had a relationship with this child. And they were so close, they're sleeping together, they're going to the bathroom together. It's very unusual. I wanted to protect that relationship, help get the good parts of it, while you know, getting appropriate 15-year-old behavior. So I'm informing Dr. Mellon about all of this because she's supposed to reunite the child with father. And I tell Dr. Mellon, no, this child is too stressed right now. She cannot handle the additional stress of meeting with father. Dr. Mellon acknowledges that, puts reunification on hold, okay? Because we're all about the child's best interest, first and foremost. After she starts to recover a bit, Dr. Mellon says, okay, it's time to start reunification. And I'm still cautious about this because I would like the child to have a longer period of rest before taking on a new stressor, but that wasn't my decision to be made. Around this same time, we realized, okay, mother is going to need treatment in order for child to get better because of the closeness of the relationship. Unfortunately, mother was very into having treatment. She was on board. Dr. Mellon recommended Lauren Day as the therapist for mother because of her expertise in all of these areas. Mother began seeing Lauren Day, and the goal was for mother and daughter to heal kind of simultaneously so that their relationship could be maintained. While we were waiting for mother to catch up, I pivoted and had the child work on her social skills. They were very, 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 very delayed. And she was excited about that. Mother was excited about that. So we had a lot of buy-in on those goals too. It gave the child time also to not be so scared by the changes in her understanding that were occurring. So there's a lot of intricate decisions about timing here as to the pace of treatment. I know one of the issues that has troubled the board is a lack of a treatment plan here. And is it okay if I talk about that, Mark?
I'm sorry?
Is it okay if I talk about that? The treatment plan.
Yes.
Okay. This is not my usual practice. If you go back to when I first started providing private practice, you will find detailed, probably ridiculously detailed treatment plans. In this case, it was so complicated and had to synchronize between mother's functioning, father's functioning, and the child's functioning that Dr. Mellon and I collaboratively decided what would be an appropriate treatment approach at this time. Those decisions are documented in Dr. Mellon's reports to the court.
Let me interrupt a bit. Did you frequently provide Dr. Mellon with reports relating to your therapy of the child?
Yes.
Did Dr. Mellon ever complain about the accuracy, adequacy, or timeliness of those reports?
No. Sometimes she said I spent too much time on my notes, but that was the extent of her advice. So when we were providing, when we'd have these joint sessions of our own planning, Dr. Mellon would often document the things relating to the big picture. What are the issues that are going to be addressed? How are they going to be met? Where's the progress? When it was more about, like if Dr. Mellon and I met with the child and father, and we needed to collect or document data about the traumatic responses we saw or the lack of traumatic responses, I would document those. So when the board reviews my records right now, it does look confusing and incomplete. I can understand that. But in this case, in order to see the full case, you would also need to see Dr. Mellon's records. And unlike my typical practice of, and it's just a usual case, I use the templates in the software program that I use. Here, I knew almost immediately that I was going to have to testify in this case, issues about my credibility, what is real, what is happening. Extensive notes needed to be taken. And I took those in a Word document, many Word documents. And so those were part of the medical record, but I could see how if you didn't understand what was going on in reviewing my file, why it wouldn't be easy for an outsider to see what was going on.
At what point, Dr. Sade, did FDIA become suspected?
We don't want to be careful. I don't think that there's a you weren't diagnosing anyone but your patient. Ms. Galvin, I'm trying to make sure we stay out of a situation of making.
I honestly could not hear his question. I'm having a very difficult time hearing Mr. Harrison.
Yeah, Mr. Harrison, can you speak to the mic?
Mark, the question. The microphone is here.
My question, Madam Chair, was at what point did FDIA become suspected?
I think I can answer that without.
Ms. Galvin, are you comfortable with that?
I think the board needs to determine whether that is relevant.
Okay. Let me ask board members, do you feel that that's a relevant issue? In this situation, a detection of a different party than who is the patient.
Could I
speak? Let me talk to my board, please.
Cat's well out of the bag.
All right. Any other comments? All right. Go ahead and answer the question.
And I do want to say I have never diagnosed mother of anything. I do not know whether she has any conditions.
Go ahead and answer
the mother's relationship, because I'm working on a parent-child relationship.
Then let's talk about what we're working on.
Okay, I was targeting the parent-child relationships. And so there's a protocol that has to be followed when the parent in that relationship has that condition suspected. I didn't honestly believe that mother, I really liked mother. We got along great. She was very involved in the therapy. She would call me frequently about, what should I do now? It was very collaborative. Until I started to recommend that the child differentiate and do age-appropriate behaviors like sleep in her own bed. When I saw this pattern of the child wanting to differentiate and there being some resistance or the child then becoming sick after attempting to do that, then I realized, oh my goodness, I think we might have a situation here. At that point, I called Farron Akins.
Why did you call Farron Akins? As the board knows, is both a psychologist and a lawyer, and Dr. Sade called him for advice about how to share information in a case in which she was getting what she previously testified to was competing views of reality. So why did you call it?
So I paid Farron Akin for some legal advice, and Dr. Mellon knew about this and was on board with it as well, also wanted to have a legal opinion about what we do in this situation. My dilemma was that when a child made progress, I was afraid to tell mother because the child would then have backlash at home. She would get sick. But then on the other hand, I needed to tell father, she is more curious about you and wants to know how to repair this relationship. So I asked Graham what to do in this situation, and he said that as long as one of the parents was aware of the progress, that should be adequate. And to be very patient and kind of modest in my expectations for progress, unless the whole family system is experiencing it. So what my dilemma was is, how do I continue to treat a child when the child can't hang on, make much progress? Because usually I would say to the family, look, you know, maybe I'm not the right provider. I'm not sure what's going on here, but we're just not making progress, and so we need to address that. So I got his advice, and then I also reported to DCS. DCS did not take the case, and as I understood it, that did not relieve me of an obligation to try and minimize the child's anxiety, distress in the mother-child relationship. Can you tell me the question again?
Well, my last question was, what advice did Farron Akins give you about the sharing of information?
Yes. To share information, it was okay as long as one parent was aware of like the progress. Both parents were very aware of the treatment, and mother would often visit with me at the end of sessions and want updates. And so there was no lack of transparency about what I was doing. It was the child's progress that I had to be careful with.
It's my understanding that you were billing the father for the services you were providing to the child.
Yes, father paid for everything, including Dr. Mellon's services, Lauren Day's services, his own therapy services.
Did he ever complain to you about your bills?
No, no. In fact, he made a declaration and supplied it to the court, or not the court, the board, reiterating his satisfaction with services and that he did not feel like he was overcharged.
At what point did mother become resistant to the whole idea of reunification with father and child?
This is a difficult question to answer because information was so, it's like quicksand. At the beginning of a session, she would start by saying, of course I want my daughter to have a relationship with her father. And then she would say, sobbing, I think, you know, he might kill her. And then say, but I know we have to go forward with it, but I'm so sorry for you, daughter, that you have to experience this. And so very mixed messages for the child, so stressful and confusing.
Who initiated the idea of inpatient residential treatment for the child?
So by mid-June, so I haven't been treating her for maybe 10 weeks. Once the school year ended, we decided to ramp up sessions and try and make it, try and stabilize her better. And so for about 5 weeks, we tried 4 sessions a week. And what it was is 2 days of individual therapy and 2 days of therapeutic supervision as part of Dr. Mellon's graduated plan of reunifying them. From my perspective, what I focused on was how well the child was doing. She was not making progress in a lot of ways. By the end of July, she was suffering. She was getting sick. Her anxiety was through the roof. And I was not making progress. School was going to start in about a month, and I was very worried about whether she would be able to attend. Lauren Day also was working with mother, had concerns about the characteristics and signs that she saw in that treatment, and recommended that a separation test would be helpful.
Is this the separation test to which Dr. Cahill testified previously?
Yes.
And what does it mean? What would it mean?
It means the mother and the child goes to a controlled facility like a residential treatment center, and there's no contact between the mother and the child. Lauren Day has expertise she was a clinical director in a residential treatment center, and so she has a lot of knowledge about how they operate and what to look for in those centers. And then Dr. Mellon had her own objective and perspective, and that was about reunification. That, and I'm sure she can tell you about this, but generally speaking, the child was only willing to meet with father as part of the reunification effort if I attended. So I did. And we met with Dr. Mellon and father, and we had these office visits. Dr. Mellon's next step was to have the child go out into the community, go to Chick-fil-A, go to IKEA. And that the child and mother insisted that I attend and provide comfort to the child, help her process it. Dr. Mellon's last step in that process was for the child and the father to go without me. And at that point, the child said, "You're going to have to get the police to drag me. I'm not going without Dr. Stick." So Dr. Mellon saw that this, and that's when mother was saying, you know, he's going to kill her, all this confusing information. So Dr. Mellon, it's a separation test as part of reunification. So that, and there's a model about this, she knows about it, it's not something I do. Where the child has time away from the parent that is aligned, so that child can then start developing their own views about the parent from whom they're estranged. So from all three perspectives, I thought she should go just so that she could receive a higher level of care, get ready for school. All three providers agreed that this would be a good decision. I was worried about how the child would respond because she's never been apart from her mother. Fortunately, everybody was on board.
By everybody, you mean you, Dr. Mellon, Lauren Day, and father's therapist?
All providers were on board, but the parents were on board too. They thought it was a great idea. The child needed no convincing. She's like, "Get me out of here." Bouncing between these different realities is very, very stressful.
So how did you decide on Paradigm Residential Treatment Center?
Dr. Mellon asked Lauren Day and I to look into it. We were the appropriate people because I knew the child's characteristics very well, and she knew, she has more of a knowledge about how residential treatment centers work. We had a really hard time finding a place that would meet the unique characteristics of this child. We didn't want anywhere that was punitive. She didn't need to be punished. She needed to be nurtured and really just be given a safe space to be for a while.
So you all agreed on Paradigm.
Well, yes, I had sent a child to Paradigm previously and had a positive experience. When I spoke with their intake, they said, yes, we treat children who have been suspected victims of this situation, high conflict divorce, and the medical and health issues. It seemed like the right fit.
Did you specifically discuss with the people at Paradigm before the child went there about the need for complete separation?
Absolutely. At one point, mother sent granola bars to the residential treatment center. Mother told her therapist, the therapist alerted me. I alerted the center, said, "You've got to get those granola bars. We can't have them around the child." And they were on board.
And why, in the view of the team, was complete separation of mother and daughter justified?
Well, for the three reasons. I honestly didn't have as much of an opinion on that. I just wanted the child at an appropriate level of care. But I understood that the separation test for the protocol for Munchausen by proxy required it, and Dr. Mellon with the reunification issues. Well, what was wonderful is that, you know, within a week of being at the center, she got better. She was able to eat a variety of foods. She used to believe that she had to lay, you know, she couldn't do typical activities if she had menstruation. She was able to do them at the center. She thought she had a heart condition and couldn't walk upstairs and couldn't be physically exerting herself. She was going to the gym and engaging in typical activities. She improved physically very quickly. She also, after, I think it was week two, reunited with her father after one video session. They had one video session and father and daughter wishing love at each other. It was a miracle. None of us expected this to happen. So things are going great. The idea of introducing mother into this dynamic was, child's not going to be there that long. Would the child lose the progress that she had? That was my concern. But, I wasn't driving that bus.
At what point did the paradigm team change its perspective about the therapy decisions, especially separation?
I was very surprised by that. What happened was Lauren Day requested from Dr. Mellon that she be allowed to directly communicate with Paradigm. And previously, I had been the liaison between Paradigm and the treatment team. And so Dr. Mellon gave that permission. And Lauren Day talked to the main therapist there, Lisa Herr, and said, I'm a little concerned because my client used to be able to think flexibly on some of these issues. And now, since my client, mother, has been talking to you, she's lost some of that flexibility and has adopted the position that Dr. Sade and Dr. Mellon are not good therapists, that they don't know what they're doing, that separation is wrong or something like that.
Do you know why their views shifted?
Well, I don't know 100% why, but that therapist told Lauren Day, I don't believe it's ethical to separate a mother and a child, just fundamentally.
What services were you providing while the child was at Paradigm?
A wide variety. And they're outlined in Dr. Mellon's TI report. I had conducted psychological testing before the child went to RTC, and I had just given a verbal report to the parents and child. But the lawyers wanted that transformed into a report, so I wrote a report. And I had to write another report for the school system. You don't share the same information in both reports. I helped provide clinical data to Dr. Mellon for her reports.
And were all these reports prepared at the recommendation or request of Dr. Mellon?
Yes. I also had sessions with the child while at RTC with Dr. Mellon. I had a session with mother and Dr. Mellon. I researched boarding schools to try and find an appropriate place for the child to go after discharge. I reviewed medical records, and what would happen was I would see something from a long time ago and then alert the therapist at Paradigm, hey, there might be an issue relating to this, you might want to probe into it. And help Dr. Mellon interpret those records by saying, this time when she had this medical procedure, that's when dad left the house.
What have you done to specifically address the board's previously stated concerns about record keeping?
Well, it's interesting because when the board, I was really surprised the board expressed those concerns, and I just assumed that they were right. Because you're doing a lot more than I did. I'm newer at this. Then I think what happened was the way I organized my records were not understood by the board. I'm all about learning, though, and I'm not perfect. So I did every CEU I could find on record keeping. I reviewed, I recognized in the last hearing that I wasn't able to answer questions posed by the board, and I reviewed the joint statement for the commission, all the health insurance stuff. I've gone through all of my files, made sure the treatment plans are appropriate and up to date and they work. And I've been more careful in my forensic cases to have record keeping that is independent or specifically references another provider's files.
Is it your practice to have treatment plans in your cases?
Yes, I do could show you them from back from 2017 when I started.
Let me ask a difficult question. How has this complaint affected you?
I hate this question.
I know.
I've spent more than 100 hours on this defense. You know, DCS asked me to take more of these cases, and I said no. And I feel kind of guilty about that. But I can't go through this again. My credibility as a younger psychologist has been questioned. This is a nightmare. And it's so confusing because I feel like I did all the things you're supposed to do. I consulted. I followed best practices. The child is well. We achieved a pretty miraculous outcome here. And it makes me very nervous about practicing psychology.
Are you aware of an ongoing investigation into mother's conduct?
Yes.
To your knowledge, who's investigating it?
I was contacted by a detective who wants me to testify against, to testify in the criminal proceedings against mother, which I don't want to do. My God, no therapist wants to do that. But I also don't know, child protection needs.
Ms. Chairman, I don't think any potential ancillary criminal proceedings is relevant to the board's consideration of the underlying issue.
Only insofar as it affects the credibility of the complainant, but I have no further questions about that anyhow, Jean. So is there anything else you want to say?
No.
I have no further questions.
All right, thank you. The board members, I'm sure, have some questions. I'll start out. Could you please discuss, there was a letter from Paradigm that I believe was sent to you or your Dr. Mellon, that was addressed to a judge, but it wasn't given to the judge. Can you explain whose decision it was not to relay that to a judge?